Again, and welcome to the 86 Celtics Interviews podcast from CSNNE.com. I'm Abby Chin. In this episode, we feature Peter May. He covered the Celtics for the Hartford Current and the Boston Globe and published a book on the 86 Celtics called The Last Banner, which was released in 1996. Jim Aberdale, producer of CSN's documentary on the 86 Celtics, sat down with Peter, and their conversation started off on his time covering the team.
Yeah, I covered them for the Hartford Current, the Celtics, from 1983 through 1990. At the time, the Celtics played three games a year down there, which they don't do anymore and haven't done since the Fleet Center opened, now the TD Garden, which was 95. And they also played an exhibition game down there. So there was a sizable Celtic contingency down there, fans, fan base. And from then, I went to the Globe in 1990 and covered them. As I did for the Current. But the Current was making a big splash in Boston sports. They covered the Red Sox. They covered the Yankees as well. So it was a nice time to be working at a place like that, because they had a lot of resources and they didn't hesitate to use them. In the mid-80s, the Celtics, I think, were unquestionably the top sports team in Boston in terms of popularity. And it was all driven by Larry Bird. He was the face of the franchise. He was their most famous player. He was their best player. And they were essentially a collection of rock stars. I mean, they would, everywhere we went with them on the road, there would be, we call them the green people. They would be in the lobbies of the hotels waiting for them when they got there. They would be waiting for buses to and from games, to and from practices. It was astonishing to see. And you see it now, of course, when the Patriots go to the Super Bowl, you see all these people in hotel lobbies and stuff like that. But back, this was during the regular season for a game in Oakland in like, you know, February. Everybody would be out in the lobby. And especially this was true in the Western Conference, because they only played there once a year. So it was a big deal when the Celtics came in. And much the same as the Patriots is now, you would find opposing arenas, maybe half Celtic fans, especially teams that weren't very good.
You know, the Celtics lost to the Lakers in the Garden, at the old Boston Garden in the May of 85, after winning game one, 148-114, and then it all went to hell and things went bad. So how disappointing was it for the franchise, the team, to suffer this nasty loss to the Lakers, and how did that serve as motivation for the summer ahead?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I think it was, in terms of how the team felt, I think this was for the Lakers a bigger deal winning than it was for the Celtics losing, and because they won in Boston. And Pat Riley to this day will tell you that is probably his most significant moment in the NBA, was beating the Celtics in Boston to win the NBA championship. And what the Celtics learned from that was that you can't play five guys all year. And that's what happened that year. They basically went with their starting five, which was the same starting five in 85-86, but they wore down as the season went on, and the Lakers didn't. And what that led to was a decision on the part of the team to really amp up in the off season, to get good players to come off the bench. The starting five wasn't going anywhere, but they needed help. And that led to the unending romance of Bill Walton, which went all summer, the signing of Jerry Seasting, the drafting of Sam Vincent, and also the signing of Sly Williams, which at the time was a big deal because he was a legitimate NBA player. He didn't turn out to be so good, so they ended up getting David Thurkill instead. But that was the genesis to build the team outwards from the nucleus, because the nucleus was solid. They just wore out against the Lakers.
Speaking of the nucleus, I know obviously they were together for a few years and had, you know, won a title in 84, but can you just describe Red's acumen in putting the starting five together from the Larry draft situation to the trade with Robert and Kevin, et cetera, with the other two as well?
Yeah, well, the story of that starting five is all of them were obtained by Red in very, like, what today would be called larcenous ways. I mean, Larry was plucked from the draft a year before he was eligible. You can't, that situation no longer exists. You can't, I mean, there's no draft eligible, junior year eligible, anything like that. Red drafted him sixth overall. Everybody knew he was available. Everybody knew he was good. Red was the one that did it. He had another first round pick. He could afford to do it, but he did it, and no one else did. Red traded for Parrish and drafted McHale in 1980, led to the first championship in 81 for that group. You know, he had the number one pick in the draft. He traded it for Parrish, and then he drafted McHale at number three. So there's three players right there, that front line, that were all obtained by really, really smart trades. Danny Ainge, I'm playing baseball. I'm not going to play basketball, he said. Well, Red said, okay, I'll take you. He took him in the second round. And Dennis Johnson was stolen from Phoenix for Rick Rohde. Absolutely stolen. I mean, you got a Hall of Fame caliber player there going for a guy who was a drinking buddy of Larry's, essentially. I mean, Rick was a good player, but Dennis Johnson was a, and he's what they needed because they needed somebody to guard the good guards in the backcourt. So all five of them were like Red just used his like acumen and his intelligence and his shrewdness, and he stole them all. And people wonder today why, you know, well, how good was he? The guy was a genius. I mean, he did it.
I'm going to throw out a name, and you can just tell me how they came to be as far as part of a member of the 85-86 Celtics and maybe a few attributes. So skipping Walton for now, I'm going to throw out Jerry Seasting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jerry was a free agent in 85, and he fit a need on that team. They were looking for a third guard. They had Ray Williams in the year before. That didn't work out. They were looking for a third guard, and back in those days, your third guard was basically a combo guard. The Celtics didn't have a classic point guard on that team. Dennis Johnson was sort of the point guard, but Danny ran the team. Larry was the point forward. The backup guard was a point, a guy who could play both point and shoot. Jerry could do both. He was a very good outside shooter, which helped on a team like Boston, which played inside out. And he could handle the ball. And there are a number of occasions that year when Danny got hurt and he started and he played very well. He's exactly what they needed. And he didn't mind coming off the bench, which was a key on that team. I mean, you don't come into the Celtics in 85 and think you're going to start because that wasn't going to happen. He knew that. So he was a perfect acquisition for that team. He did exactly what they needed him to do. Scott Wedman had been there for a couple years. And he was probably the best pure shooter on that team. Just a great, great shooter. The problem was is he was playing Larry Bird's position, so he wasn't going to take minutes away from Larry Bird. But he showed how important he was to that team when Kevin McHale got hurt in the middle of the season and missed, I think, 18 games. They went 15-3 without him, and that was Scotty starting those games. And, you know, one of the funny anecdotes from the year is when they were in Washington and Wedman had a great game and he's reading the paper the next day, which is what they all did back then. You know, before they got on the bus, they actually read the paper. They never bought it, but they read it. And he's reading and the headline says, Wedman leads Celtics to victory or something like that. And Bird goes by him and says, you know, that'll be the last time that ever happens. You know, and soon he was back on the bench. But he was a weapon. You know, he's one of those guys that could come in and get you quick baskets. Not the greatest defender in the world, but didn't have to be. He had a role, in a lot like Seasting's role. He's a great outside shooter. That's what they needed him for.
Continue on with the rest of the roster. Sam Vincent.
Sam was the number one draft pick that year out of Michigan State. And I think if you put a gun to Red's head, he probably would admit he should have drafted Terry Porter, but he didn't. But Sam was a great college player at Michigan State. And, you know, rookies coming into the NBA at that point were 3 and 4 year college players for the most part. So he was a good player. He never got an opportunity on that team to play. And there was always a sense with Sam that he thought he was a little bit more entitled than he really should have been. In other words, he thought he should have been playing more than he was. And I mean, he was the fourth guard, maybe the fifth, depending on Rick Carlisle, and, you know, on who Casey figured it that day. I mean, rookies just didn't play on that team, on good teams. You never saw rookies playing for the Lakers. You never saw rookies playing for the Celtics. The, you know, these were established, veteran, good teams. And if you're a rookie, you're like Greg Kite or Sam. You just got to, you know, take your lumps. And I think Sam always was a little resentful of that. I think he thought he should have played more. But he wasn't going to get the chance to play much on that team. He was another guy that really had to do his due diligence in the practice. That was where, you know, he pushed the players, pushed them. And as an aside, every player will tell you that the best moments of that season were the practices at Helena College, because they bordered on the ferocious. And the green team, which was the reserves, took great pride in beating the starters. And they did a lot of times. And a lot of reason was because of Sam and because of Scotty Wedman and the guys that didn't start and didn't play a lot. That was their time to really take it out on them. And there was, of course, no end to the ribbing and razzing that went on.
Rick Carlisle.
I always pegged him as a future coach. You know, what happened to him anyway? smart, just really smart. And he was maybe 23 or 4 when he was drafted, because he, you know, he did two years at Maine, then he had to sit out a year when he went to Virginia. So he was an old rookie when he came in. And he came in and he beat out their number one draft pick in 84, Michael Young from Houston, and got it, and, you know, was just the only major rookie on the team. So by that time, he'd been in the league 3 years. He knew exactly what his role was. And again, he's like a great practice player who, when called upon, as in the Laker game in L.A., can make big shots and make big contributions. And that was his role. And he knew that. He was a very good practice player, but really, really smart. I mean, again, he might have been a step ahead of a lot of guys on that team in terms of just sheer smarts and sheer basketball knowledge. And I think it's shown itself to be true with his, you know, successful coaching career. But just a really smart guy. That's what stuck out with me with Rick. I thought, he's going to coach somewhere someday. He's just really, really smart.
Describe what the summer was like waiting for this Walton deal to happen, and how Bill called up the offices, and a very unique situation, it seems like.
It was mutual love. No question about it. He wanted to come here, and the Celtics wanted him to come. But the fly in the ointment was Donald Sterling, who was the owner of the Clippers at the time, and they just couldn't get a deal done where Sterling would say, "Yeah, okay," and then the next day he'd say, "No, wait a minute. If they're trading him, how can he be any good?" The deal went down for Cedric Maxwell. And there were salary cap ramifications at the time that needed to be addressed. But we all knew the deal was going to be Bill for Cedric. Cedric had angered Red Auerbach because he had been hurt the year before, and he didn't come to training camp or summer league. And to this day, Cedric will tell you, "Why should I have to go to summer league? I was a veteran at the time. I was recovering from an injury." Well, Red wanted him there. That's why. And he didn't come. So, boom, see you later. And Bill was a perfect guy to have come in. He was at a point in his career where he'd been hurt for so long, he hadn't won for so long, and he needed something fresh and something new. It just took forever because Donald Sterling couldn't nail him down, or get the Clippers people couldn't even nail him down. I mean, their general manager at the time, Carl Scheer, was exasperated with him because he thought he had a deal. Next thing you know, he doesn't have a deal. So once, it took all summer for them to finally convince Donald that, yes, we have to make this deal. Bill will go, and, you know, you'll get Cedric. But it was all Donald Sterling that was the fly. He was the fly in the ointment. When anybody asks you about the greatest teams, you can say, well, how many had a Hall of Fame center as your sixth man, okay? And that's what Bill was. And he was healthy. I mean, he played almost the entire season. I don't think he missed more than five or six games. And that he hadn't done that for years. So his health was a huge thing. And his enthusiasm was infectious and contagious. And he lived for practices, and he lived for big games. I mean, if you go back and chart his games that year, the Laker games were big games. The Sixer game was a big game. He just really, really embraced the whole culture of that team. And he was a not only was he a great player, he was a great passer, great rebounder, shot blocker, and he could cram all these unbelievable numbers into like 15 minutes on the floor and do it enthusiastically. And he just loved that year. That was by far his most favorite year in the NBA, I would have to guess, even beating the Portland year. Because he was around Hall of Famers like himself, and he just enjoyed that season so much. He was the target of endless ribbing all year long. The happiest guy on the team to have him there was Danny, because before Bill, everybody picked on Danny. So now they're picking on Bill, and Danny was one of the chief picker-honors. So it was kind of a role reversal for him. But he just enjoyed that season so much, and he was a real weapon coming off the bench because he could do so many things. And it was health. I mean, that was the number one thing. He'd never been healthy for the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. He never got healthy. And then, boom, he had that 1 year in Boston, and then, you know, it went the other way.
Were these guys the most intensive trash talkers you've ever seen, and why? And can you cite some examples? Obviously, it started with Larry on down, but these guys were really talking the talk, it seemed like.
They were. They were incorrigible trash talkers, mostly with each other. But, I mean, they did all kinds of things. They had a big comeback win in Atlanta that year. And at the end of the game, Dominique Wilkins went to the line. Larry did one of these, which is, you know, that's trash talking in its own way, I guess. He missed the free throws. So they did. They were Bird was by far the worst of the lot in terms of the trash talking. But he backed it up. But the inside the locker room, they were on each other all the time too, and it was a fun team to cover. If you were a writer covering that team, you had endless sources of good stuff to go to. I mean, you had Bird, you had McHale, you had Parrish, you had Ainge, you had Dennis Johnson, you had Bill Walton. You know, who after the opening night said, "I'm a disgrace to the game of basketball," and you know when they lost to the Nets, a game they never should have lost, They were a great group of guys. They all got along. The chemistry was terrific, and these, you know, and if they ML Carr wasn't there, I mean, you know, he was on the team the year before, but I mean, it was just they were always talking, yakking. Bill, you know, Patty Hearst sleeping in your basement still, you know, that kind of stuff, and you know, we lapped it up. We loved it. I mean, they were. They were a fun group to be around and a fun group to cover, not just because they were good guys, but they were great players too.
Just a couple quick follows on the trash talking. How about just the three-pointer stuff where Danny thought he was a better shooter than...
Danny thought Larry was the third best three-point shooter on the team, behind him and Scott Wedman. And he never let him forget that. And then the thing with Larry, I think the prize that year was $10,000 for first place in the three-point shot contest. And you know, Larry was making almost $2 million a year, so I mean, he probably still has the first dime he ever made. But that to him, you know, if I can make 10 grand shooting threes, I mean, how bad is that? So he practiced for it. He really, you know, you could see him after practicing. But Danny and Scotty never let him forget that, you know, yeah, you might be in this contest, but you're only the third best shooter on the team. And after he won the contest, Danny reminded me, yeah, but you didn't go against the best, which is me. So that sort of thing, yeah. And Larry, of course, was, "I'm the three-point king," and, you know, walks into the locker room before the contest and says, "Who's here going to finish in second?" You know, one of those things. But he backed it up. He backed it up.
Was this the greatest passing team of all time, and why were they so great, and who was so great?
I mean, you'd start with the fact that, yes, I think it was the best passing team. Certainly the best passing team I've ever seen. You start with the fact that you had the best passing forward probably in the history of the game in Larry Bird. and you had the best passing center in the, one of the best passing centers in Bill Walton. And so that mentality pervaded the whole team. And then you had Dennis Johnson, who's a great passer. Danny's a great passer. I can always remember Larry getting down on the post and then right over the shoulder to a cutting Robert Parrish for a dunk, not even looking. They took pride in that. They took pride in their passing because, you know, that epitomized the unselfishness of that team. And they were an unselfish team. They may have razzed each other and Danny might have tried to win the free throw title, you know, but they were, in essence and at the core, a very unselfish team. They didn't care who scored the points. They didn't care who got the assist. They wanted to win, and that was the only thing that mattered to them. And the unselfishness is borne out by what a great passing team they were. Because Larry was passing, passed through people's legs, passed around people's heads, passed without looking. And Bill, he might be the best passing center of all time. I mean, he was a great outlet passer. He was a great passer from the post. When, as Danny would note, he wasn't fumbling it instead, but that's Bill. He was a terrific passer, and again, that was the mentality of that team.
It seems like those guys took pleasure in almost humiliating someone with a pass. Is that kind of accurate? Like, they were good, but I think it was almost more of a shot at the other team that we could make you look silly. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true of the age as well. That the dunk was. It isn't what it is now in terms of I got to get on SportsCenter with this dunk. They beat you. It was like death by a thousand cuts with them. And, the passes were part of those thousand cuts. And they enjoyed that as much as anything else. They didn't enjoy, nobody, dunked on anybody or anything like that. Half the team probably couldn't even dunk anyway. But that was their raison d'etre, was when they were on the floor, was to pick the other team apart. And it really was kind of like, almost like surgery, the way they did it. And passing was their scalpel. That's how they did it. They took teams apart by passing, and they took great pride in that.
What was it like watching this team dominate at home?
Yes. Especially over the second half of the year, this team was not only didn't lose at home, wasn't even really threatened at home. I laugh when I hear people talk about how good the Golden State Warriors were last year. And, oh, my God, they were like, they only lost two games at home. Give me a break. I mean, these guys went 40-1 at home. They never trailed in any playoff series. They never even tied in any playoff series. They won all their home games at the Garden in the playoffs. The only one that was close was the Michael Jordan double overtime game, the first game of the playoffs. They just had this thing about the Garden, and once they got through December and the Christmas game, and Larry got healthy, which was key, they just became a force at home, and nobody was even close to beating them at home. The home games were like ridiculous. I can remember Frank Layden coming out of the locker room and he's looking at us and he goes, "What, we were supposed to win?" And that was the mentality. I mean, they had teams beat before they even took the floor back then in those games. They just were so good. They were pretty good on the road too. But they were better at home, like most teams. They won 67 games that year, and I can think of like 10 that they simply just botched for no reason. They could have won 75 games that year if they really set their mind to it.
Let's talk real quick about the January comeback game against Dominique. What were your memories from that night?
Right. My memories from that night are that, Atlanta was trying to build itself up as a serious team in the Eastern Conference. And you have to remember at that time, the Eastern Conference was loaded. You had the Celtics. You had a very good Milwaukee team, which just by virtue of having to be, having the Celtics and Sixers good at the same time, never did anything. Never got to the finals or anything. That was a really good team, And, you know, if they'd been in the other conference, maybe they would have gotten out. And that was always the thing about the Celtics. They always expected to see the Lakers come out of the West, because the West at that time was like the East is now. There was this one really good team and nobody else really. The East was the West. The East was stocked. And the Celtics had to get through Philly, Milwaukee, and Atlanta was one of these teams that was kind of nudging its way up to the point where, you know, 3 or 4 years down the road, they'd be really, really good. They sold out the arena that night. I think it was the largest crowd in the history of the franchise showed up for this game. And they were up, I want to say, they were up by 20 in the first half and by more than 20 at halftime. And at the second half, Larry came out to the referees and said to them, you know, don't quit on us because we're not going to quit either. So, you know, keep your whistles. Don't put them in your pockets. And they, by the end of the third quarter, I think they cut the lead to 10 or something manageable, tied it, and then Dominique had a chance to win the game at the free throw line, and he missed two free throws after Larry gave him the choke sign. Celtics went on to win. And, you know, that's an example of, you know, when they put their minds to it, you know, they were so good. It's just that they tended to coast because they were so good, and they couldn't, you know, coasting can get you into trouble, no matter whether you're, you know, a student or a basketball player, whatever you are. You know, coasting is not always the best thing to do. And they did a lot of coasting because they could. They were so good. That was just a knife in the back for Atlanta. They're thinking, we got this game won, and, you know, boom.
Take me through the... obviously, had been a dunk contest before, but this was the inaugural three-point contest in February.
Yes.
So, take me through that day, and, you know, the locker room stuff with Larry, and then the on-court stuff. Just one more time, from just kind of soup to nuts on the three-point contest.
Yeah, that was the three-point contest was started for the 1986 All-Star Game in Dallas, and Larry was selected, and again, much to the bemusement of Danny Ainge and Scott Wedman, who thought they were better three-point shooters. But you just have it, you're starting something from scratch. You want it to be accepted. You want Larry Bird in there. And Larry, of course, was happy to do it. And any chance to make $10,000, he'd be up for that. It's like it is now. It went through different rounds. And then for the final round, he put on a jacket at the... I think it was at the suggestion of John Havlicek, who was down there for Legends, the Legends game or whatever in Dallas. And Larry won the tournament easily in the final round. He beat Craig Hodges. And, you know, he shows up at the news conference saying, I'm the three-point king. And he's raising his finger and, you know, telling, you know, I told you guys I'd do this. None of you guys, I think he singled out Dan Shaughnessy. Said, you know, you didn't think I could do this. And, It was great theater. It really was. The best thing about it was that, you know, he had called it. He had gone into the locker room before the contest and looked around at everybody in there and said, okay, which one of you guys is coming in second? And then he went out and did it. And he did it 3 years in a row or 2 years in a row. Anyway, he won it again. So it wasn't a fluke. I mean, he loved this was one of the things he really liked doing, not so much for the money, but just to remind people, yeah, you know, I'm the best three-point shooter out there, so don't forget it. That's Larry.
What do you remember, and we went through a lot of the facts in the book, about the February, March, April dominance?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they went out west in February, and they wanted to... They had seven games. They wanted to win at least five of them, and they only won four. And that's just, Kevin was not playing, and Bill missed the last game of the trip, which was a loss in Denver. I mean, you look at that thing. They lost to Sacramento at home to start that trip. I mean, how bad is that? You know, because, again, they just screwed it up. They coasted. Larry missed free throws at the end of that game. But once they got back from that trip, the first game all was back after the West Coast trip in those days was a game in Hartford. They always went down to Hartford. And so they went down to Hartford, and they think they thumped Indiana pretty well. And that got him back going. And then over the last, 2.5 months, they just rolled over everybody. And by the time March and April rolled around, the Atlantic Division was not an issue anymore. Philadelphia was too far behind. So now they're looking at the Lakers for the best record. They're going to get the best record. And they just kept pouring it on. And I think there was a certain, they were proud of what they were doing at home. They wanted to keep that going as well. They didn't want to lose at home anymore. So that produced some of their best games. And at that point in the season, too, you've got teams that they're beating that aren't going into the playoffs or have no hope. And, they're showing up and they're getting crushed. So they just, I think everything clicked in. Larry got healthy. The rotation solidified. Kevin came back from missing his game. So they gave him plenty of time to get healthy. I mean, 18 games is a lot of games to miss. And but they didn't want him back until he was healthy, because he tried to come back at the All-Star game and re-injured his Achilles. And that was a bolt out of the blue to them, saying, wait a minute, we don't want Kevin back until he's perfect. And so he came back and he was fine. And they just were rolling. I mean, every game you covered, you could stop keeping score in like the third quarter because it was over. I mean, they were so dominant.
Could this team have won 70 games? Why or why not? I know you talked about kind of letting the foot off the gas pedal at times.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't think there's any question about that, and I think they would tell you that as well if it was something that they really cared about. They didn't care about that. I mean, I never once heard them talk at any point that year about, let's get the best record in the history of the NBA. Let's win 70. That just wasn't an issue to them. The issue to them was winning the NBA championship, which they had won 2 years earlier and then lost the year before. So that was what the season was all about for them, not breaking any records for wins. Having said that, they look back now, and I know Kevin does because I talked to Kevin about this. He said, man, what were we thinking? We could have won 75 games that year if we had really put our minds to it. If that had been an important goal for them, that they feel to a man that they could have done it if they'd wanted to. And they lost some stupid games that year. And you just look back, they won 67, and you can think back, opening night, we talked about that. They shouldn't have lost that game. They lost a game in Indiana on a tip-in by Clark Kellogg, I think. I mean, they lost in Sacramento. I mean, they just lost games they shouldn't have lost. And it was never an issue with them. They never once that I ever heard talked about, let's win 70, which would have broken the Lakers record at the time of 69. And that was three more wins. And you can just go through that season and pick off 5, 6, 7 games easily of the 15 that they lost that they should have won. So yes, they should have won more. And I think if they had to do it over again, I think they'd do it exactly the same way, but they would do it with kind of a, let's see how many we can win because we're really, really good and this may never come back again. And I think maybe they might, grudgingly admit that kind of bugs them a little bit. They won the title, so that's fine. But they were. I mean, I think they still are. I mean, I'm always think they're the best team that ever was assembled, but the record doesn't say that they are, so.
Can you describe Larry's dominance, and it was his third straight MVP award, but specifically in 85-86, how he was dominant and won the MVP to show for it?
Yeah. Well, I think by that point, by 85-86, we were all, it was almost like watching Brady, you're almost take his greatness for granted. He'd won in two straight MVPs. With Larry, it's so clear when you go back over that season, he needed to be healthy. And, the back issue that surfaced earlier in that year would be one that would force him to retire eventually. But he got it cleared up that year. And from like January on, he was as good as he's ever been. I mean, he was shooting the ball well, passing it well, and he was the, you know, he was the leader of that team, and he didn't miss games. You know, he didn't get hurt. But it was, he played through the back, and you could see he was struggling at the beginning of the year getting a shot. But once that thing cleared up, he just went on a tear. And he was right in the, he was in prime of his career. He was, what, 30 years old then, maybe? And he just, he was just perfect position to do what he did in terms of his health and his ability and his teammates and the team itself. So he, I mean, I don't think at the end of the year, I don't think anybody thought there was anybody else who should have been the most valuable player that year. He was head and shoulders above everybody else. He just had an extraordinary year, but we had become used to that. You know, that's what he had been doing for the last 5 years, three of them which were MVP years.
But can you describe Casey Jones as being perfect for this team with his hands-off approach?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but he won a title in his first year with the Celtics in 83-84, and I think the players, I mean, I remember writing about that they all thought that he was the anti-Bill Fitch in terms of he just was easygoing, he was a player's coach, he didn't micromanage, and he just let them play. And I sometimes think that, you know, Casey does get... maybe not his due credit for that team, but it wasn't for the X's and O's that team succeeded because of Casey. It was because of the atmosphere that he engendered and the way he treated everybody with respect and let them be who they are. You know, Bill Fitch is one of the best coaches in the history of the NBA, but by 1983, everybody hated him. Except Larry. And so by the time he left, Casey was he had been the assistant to Bill, and the team had seen how Bill treated him and didn't like the way Bill treated him. So when Casey became a head coach, there was a natural bond there, and they felt for him. And he let them be who they were. He let the atmosphere, you know, around these guys. He didn't do anything to stifle it. I mean, Bill Walton's kids would be running through practice. That only lasted for 1 year. But they'd been, mainly because Bill only lasted for 1 year, I guess. But his kids would be running around practice, and it was chaotic. But that's the kind of thing that they thrived on, is that they thrived on this chaos. And Casey didn't try to inhibit it. He just let it be. Because he saw that, you know, it was what was going on was working. So that was the big thing I thought with Casey. I mean, I don't think he'll ever be considered to be an X's and O's guy. But what he did was he allowed that team to be that team. He allowed them to be themselves. And in the end of the day, that's exactly what they needed.
A third quarter, game five against the Hawks. It was the perfect quarter of basketball that night.
Yes, the third quarter, 36-6. And I remember for the book and talking to Danny about that quarter, and he described it as the perfect quarter of basketball, and hard to see otherwise looking at it. I think there was a sense that they were upset that they didn't close out the Hawks in four in Atlanta, and so they had to come back and do it in Boston in game five, and I think it took a half of them to say, all right, you know, what are we doing here? Let's take care of these guys. And then they went out and they just completely destroyed Atlanta in the third quarter, ended the series right then and there. And it was just an example of, like, again, what they could do when they set their minds to it and how good they really were. I mean, you don't outscore teams 36-6 in the playoffs. You just don't. And they totally took Atlanta out of the game. And the fourth quarter was just watching the Hawks. They were just demoralized. They said, "What just hit us?" Because they had won the game in Atlanta. And, you know, Spud Webb was like the big hero, and no, they said, that ends today, and that's what they did. And you know, I'll always remember Danny calling it the perfect quarter of basketball.
As they're beating the Bucks, something is going on in the Western Conference. It's very unusual.
Yeah.
I'll just put it out there. What was going on in the Western Conference? And also, we're very interested to know, and what was the vibe on the Celtics end of things, watching what was going out on the Western Conference Finals?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the Celtics will, you know, they're not going to take down the banner in 84, I mean, in 86 and 81. But I think they will admit to you that they would have rather beaten the Lakers than the Rockets. Because the Rockets, in 81, the Rockets were basically a 500 team during the season. They weren't any good. They had Moses Malone and, you know, nobody else, basically, Robert Reed and Mike Dunleavy. And, I mean, 86, they were a better team. They had the Twin Towers they had a coach by the name of Bill Fitch. So there was a little bit of that going as well. And they surprised the Lakers. The Celtics, all that season, they measured themselves against the Lakers. Their games, the big games of the regular season, were against the Lakers. The Rockets were not even on their screen during that season. They, you know, if you would ask them, do you expect to play Houston in the finals, they would say, Houston who? I mean, it was all the Lakers all the time with them. So that was a huge shock to them. And I think, you know, to this day, I think they'll admit that, yes, they won the championship, but it would have been sweeter if they'd beaten the Lakers, because they considered the Lakers their number one rival and the second best team or best team, depending on schedules and rankings and standings and stuff. The Rockets were not even on their screen.
Let's talk about the NBA Finals series versus the Rockets, the six-game series, and I'll let you explain how that series went.
The Rockets, that series again, I mean, there was no understanding that the outcome would be anything other than it was. Let's put it that way. It was a question of when, not if. And they won the first two games in Boston easily, and I think they sort of went down to Houston thinking that they're going to win it down there. And, you know, they blew game three. They should have won game three. They lost that. They won game four, and I can distinctly remember at the end of that game, Kevin McHale doing one of these at the end of the game, because they're up 3-1. They know they're not going to lose the series now. They know it's over. And then game five, we'll remember for A, Ralph and Jerry getting in a tussle, Jerry Seasting and Ralph Sampson, to, you know, 7'4" Ralph Simpson and the 6'1" Jerry Seasting, maybe 6'1". And the Celtics just got absolutely clobbered on the boards. Jim Peterson and Ralph just and Hakeem just killed it on the boards. And so you went back to Boston thinking, well, you know, it's over. They're not going to lose two in Boston. But that's not the way you want to go back, getting your rear end kicked. And they did. That was the one game Houston absolutely, you know, deserved to win and should have won. The Celtics are thinking, we never should have had a game five, but they did. And so they come back to Boston, and they have what I remember Danny Ainge telling me was the most intense practice of the year. I don't think you'd see that in this day and age. It was at Boston Garden, and they just had, apparently, we didn't see it because we were traveling, an incredibly intense kind of practice like they used to have during the season, where everybody was like banging everybody, and they just, again, they got mad. They got mad because they blew Atlanta and didn't close it out. They got mad and they didn't close it out in Houston. And so they went out there and they took it out, and they just absolutely dominated the Rockets again in Boston for the third time and won easily. Although Bill tried to give it away at the end there with a few turnovers that Danny Ainge keeps reminding me about. Yeah, we would have won a lot easier if Bill hadn't tried to give him the game at the end. But there was never any doubt. I mean, they were a much better team than the Rockets were. I mean, the Lakers series would have been more fun, I think. But the Lakers had issues of their own that year, and they would address them as the Celtics did in 85. The Lakers would address them the following summer. They get Michael Thompson, and they become, in my opinion, the second best team ever, because that 86-87 Lakers team was really, really good.
So they win the finals. I guess, is there, we'll kind of move ahead to the aftermath. Let's just talk about, I guess let's put a cap on it, just the scene, winning on the Garden floor again. You've won, and now you've won three titles with this big three, mm-hmm. and just the ensuing days with the parade, and just the general thoughts of, you know, all right, these guys have won the title again, and they did it in a very, no question about it, kind of a
dominating way. Yeah. You know, I don't think anybody in that locker room thought that this would be the last one. These you had guys peaking in the primes of their careers. You had Bill Walton, he was signed for 3 years. I mean, everything was in place for this thing to keep going. And yes, they made it to the finals in 87 with Kevin playing on one foot. But I think if you would have asked them that day, is this the end of the era, for championships, they all would have laughed at you. It was, what are you talking about? Larry's 30, Kevin's 29, Robert's 32. I mean, they're all should be in the primes of their careers. And they're just coming off this incredible, magical season. They would still be pretty good for the next few years, but it's just the no more championships. That was unthinkable on that day that this was the last championship for that group and until 2008.
So they win the title on Sunday, June 8th.
Len Bias.
Tell me about June 19th and where you were and how you heard it and your reaction and the team's reaction to that.
Yeah, I was home. I had been out driving. We had just had our firstborn in January of '86, so I think I was out with him somewhere in the car, and I came back to our house, and my wife, who knows nothing about sports, met me at the front door and said, "Len Bias died," and I said, "What?" Because I'd been there for the day before the draft. That's back when they did it in their offices, and there wasn't this elaborate thing in New York. You just went to the Celtics offices and waited for Red to tell you who they drafted. And he'd been playing coy all along. He said, "I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that," and Bias was the guy he wanted all along. "I'm going to take Brad Doherty, I'm going to do that." No, he wanted Bias. And it was stunning. You didn't know what to think. I mean, I wasn't particularly knowledgeable about Len Bias. I didn't cover Maryland. I didn't see him play that often. I didn't know that much about him other than I thought, well, he's 6'7" and he can jump out of the gym and he's really good. So that's probably a good thing to have. But I'm looking at him and I'm saying, whose minutes is he going to take next year? He's not going to take Larry's minutes. So I'm thinking, maybe in a couple of years he'll be good. I was stunned by it. I mean, as everybody was. It just came out of nowhere. And, I think that set them back. Reggie Lewis, obviously, a few years later set them back. And for a while there, they couldn't seem to, get the sails straight.
Was this the greatest team of all time? And why was this the greatest team of all time?
All right, I'm glad you asked that question. My opinion is that, yes, this is the greatest team of all time, and for a couple of reasons. The first being that the mid-80s was, if you had, the NBA was a bell curve, the mid-80s would be right at the top. And the reason being is you had it was a 23-team league back then, which is still probably more than they needed. But when Jordan's team did it, and when they're 72 games, it was a 30-team league. So there's 105 players that he played against Jordan that weren't good enough to play in the NBA when Larry's team was going through that. I mentioned earlier about the competition that the Celtics faced just getting out of the East every year. Jordan, the Bulls never had anybody like that. you know, it was always, the Bulls were like the Lakers were in the 80s. They just, there was no real competition for them in the conference. So their regular season was not chock-a-block with, like, dynamic big games. And the question we always ask anybody is, who's going to guard Kevin? Who from that team is going to guard Kevin? Okay, Rodman. Who's going to guard Larry? Horace Grant? I don't think so. And they'll say, well, who's going to guard Michael? And we'll say, well, Michael's going to get his, but Dennis Johnson's pretty good. And who's going to guard Robert? Luke Longley? I mean, to me, it's not even an issue. As I said, I think the Lakers team the next year was almost as good as the Celtics team was in 85-86. But that team had everything. And, you know, an MVP is your sixth man. And you needed Hall of Famers in those days, in the mid-80s. You look at the Celtics team, the Hall of Famers on that team. You look at the Lakers team, the Hall of Famers on that team. And the guys that are good, like Michael Cooper, who won't get in the Hall of Fame, but is really, really good. And you go, you shift to the next decade and the Bulls, and they've got Michael and they got Scotty. And Scotty's only there because Michael was there. And there's just, it just wasn't, the competition wasn't, it wasn't there in the 90s as it was in the 80s. That was the golden era of the NBA. That's when you really had to be, you had to have Hall of Famers, not just to win, but to compete. And that, you know, that's why I think this puts them at the top, because they beat everybody at a time when the league was at its best.
One more episode to go in our 86 Celtics Interviews podcast series. On Tuesday, we wrap things up with Cedric Maxwell, who has the interesting perspective of being traded before the 85-86 season. I am Abby Chin. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the 86 Celtics Interviews. We'll be right back.